This is the audio lecture for the section on issues to do with the language used for interpreting the nature and purposes of Catholic school religious education. If you have a look at the three cartoons at the beginning of the section, they will raise some of the issues that end up being central to this section. Some degree of debate and you might say ambiguity and even confusion about the nature and purposes of religious education has always been characteristic of a field that is so important and yet is also controversial. You'll notice there that in 1980 Professor Mary Boyce from the United States said that the widespread uncertainty about the purposes of religious education accounts in some measure for its image as an endeavour prone to bandwagons, band-aids and gimmicks, a field without much historical sense, self-definition or reputation as a scholarly discipline. In short, it reflects the lack of consensus about the very nature of religious education. What she is suggesting there is that people at the scholarly level, also at the level of regional authorities and also at the level of practitioners, may often have very different estimates of what the process actually is about and what sort of outcomes it should produce. You could note there another quotation from a United States scholar and practitioner, Jim DiGiacomo, what he said about this issue especially after his experience teaching in a Jesuit school in Sydney for a year in 1984. You'll also notice that in 1970, the United States scholar Gabriel Moran pointed out that the use of ecclesiastical language like the word catechetics tended to be misleading and confusing, and he used a rather sharp title, Catechetics R.I.P., which made a lot of sense to practitioners, but which earned him some disfavour from Catholic religious education authorities in the US, and I don't think they ever forgave him for it, even though today, in 2017, he would still be the most prolific writer, author and philosopher in religious education worldwide, with many, many books, and a very significant influence, and someone who throughout his writing always pointed out the need to go back carefully to the meaning, the etymology of words, and to use them with precision and care. And I would suggest that it is his philosophy of being careful about the use of language that really underpins the whole of this section. And I hope it will show that it may seem a bit pernickety and finicky to concentrate on using language with great precision, but I hope you will see that this has so much to do with being precise in our practice. If you are very vague in what you think you're doing, it will easily flow through into vagueness of practice. So here is a situation where I think clarity of theory and clarity of language is going to be so important for its practical implications. Now have a look at the statement of religious education theory in section 1.2. Read it and see what your own reactions to it are. What's wrong with it? So what do you think? What are the issues? I would suggest that it is primarily saturation with jargon terms that are not clearly defined. All of those terms are taken from contemporary theory at the time and later, but I think you can see that when they're all put together in one artificial statement, the jargon can be overwhelming. It can stop people from thinking really clearly about what they're trying to do. It can cause confusion, as suggested in the cartoon, because you don't know which aspect of religious education you're actually doing. And it is bound to create unrealistic expectations of what people are trying to achieve, and that flows through to problems with the content and the pedagogy of teaching. I would suggest that there is no need for that degree of jargon, and that we should be suspicious and even cynical and even amused at the excessive use of jargon. And I believe that we should try in our own professional sphere to be simple, clear, unambiguous, and I think there's no place for all that jargon. All it does is camouflage what people are doing, and it's a substitute for thinking about what we're doing. It actually prevents us from being clarifying what we're really doing. Once you use jargon, it stops the critical thought process, I would argue. Anyway, that's the professional view that I've taken to this. It was an issue that I thought came up in the earliest studies that I did in religious education, 40 to 50 years ago, and it's still an issue today. I sometimes wonder, why have we not learned? My view, I think, is well substantiated in terms of the thinking of practitioners when they get to looking into this, and also the research, which points out that even parents as well as teachers think, oh yes, these terms are important, but do they help clarify the process? No, they're very confusing and ambiguous. Now, not everyone, particularly people in authority, will agree with this view, and it's not my endeavour here to convert you to my point of view, but I think my point of view has enough evidence and enough serious implications in it that it warrants looking at this issue carefully so that you make up your own mind about whether you think this is an issue or not and whether that might have any effect on the language you use for thinking and talking about religious education in the classroom. The rest of section 1.2 could be glimpsed at briefly. It's just suggesting that the language that has been used in the evolution of the church's thinking about its comprehensive ministry to the faithful from birth to death has often been applied without precision, without care, and without a sense of the possibilities and limitations of what you can do in classrooms. And therefore, I think that is what fundamentally causes the problem. Unrealistic expectations are carried through into estimates of what people think the classroom is primarily about and what it can achieve. There's a cartoon that I remember once where the student goes up to the teacher and the teacher is berating the student for not doing well enough, and they should be able to do better. And the student says to the teacher, look, it's not that I'm an underachiever, you're an overexpecter. And I think that this has often been the largest burden for religion teachers, that you get excessive ecclesiastical expectations on how people at the top can think that educating them in religion is going to change their belief and values and above all change their religious and mass behaviour. And I don't think it has anything to do with that. I think what it has to do with educating them well in their religious tradition and in religion generally and in issues, but of itself it cannot change the relationship of personal belief and commitment to God. Now at section 1.3 you jump off to another web page which is a whole subsection in itself, and it goes into the story of the term catechesis, how it originated, how it was used over the centuries, how it became a word that went with the revival of ministry to adults in the Catholic Church in the 1930s, called the catechetical movement, which also applied to religious education. And it talks about the way in which a confusion between the two had been a constant source of problems for Catholic school religious education in the classroom. And it took a long while for this to be clarified, where you had it officially recognised in 1982 in one of the Roman Congregation documents, which said, religious instruction or religious education is distinct from catechesis. The former is a detailed, systematic curriculum, study of religion, and so on. And it took a long time for that to happen. But today, there still is some problem where people tend to carry the expectations of catechesis, which in its core meaning is a voluntary, adult, faith-sharing interaction of people who meet specifically to develop and deepen their own religious knowledge and faith commitment, and that this is not the situation that you have in the average religion classroom. Now, the story of catechesis in this subsection, which is on a separate page, is pretty detailed, and how much time you're able to give to the whole story depends. And I think that the crucial thing is to understand the issues, the confusion, the ambiguity, and how it came to be clarified. I think actually the rest of this, from 1.4 to 1.12, is the real core of this section. So see the subsection 1.3 as the story of catechesis and go into it in as much detail as you feel comfortable with. I don't insist that you go through that with the same sort of sharp focus that you need to in sections 1.4 to 1.12. Now, I'll say a little bit about the text in subsection 1.3 just to highlight the principal points, and I'll leave it up to you to cover more or less as you go. Then we'll come back to 1.4. So now we need to open up the page 1.3 about clarifying the language of religious education by getting some picture of the story of the term catechesis and how it has been related to and also differentiated from religious education. The first part of 1.3 talks about catechesis in the early Christian church. And it's interesting to note that in those days, people were initially converted to belief in Jesus Christ as the Son of God and Saviour. Then they were instructed in the religious faith tradition. Then they were baptised and initiated into the Christian community, especially at the Easter vigil liturgy on Easter Saturday evening. So now what we do is we baptise them, then we instruct them in the religious faith tradition, and we keep our fingers crossed. We hope that they will have personal faith, and we hope that they will associate themselves with the religious faith community. So you can see there in 1.3.1 some of the qualities of catechesis in the early Christian church. Then the next section looks at how the Reformation changed all that because of the introduction of the catechism. Luther did it first, and through Gutenberg's press, thousands of these were made available and were given to children, where there were these neat little precise theological kernel statements about the faith of the Christian community, and they were learned off by heart. Not to be outdone, the Catholics, led by St. Canisius, a Jesuit, developed the Catholic Catechism, and so from the 16th century to the 20th, that's four to five centuries, you had the Catechism being the principal tool for instructing children, and I guess to that extent adults, in the faith tradition as they became more literate. And it was not until the mid-20th century that tradition changed. It's just interesting to note that in the 1930s, a Christian brother, Brother Ben Hanrahan, at a conference, a national conference on Australian Catholic schooling in Armidale in the early 1930s, he pointed out that the catechism approach was really an out-of-date and inappropriate method for instructing children in the religious faith tradition. But it's interesting that this call went unheeded. It was not until the 60s that people were able to say, well, yes, Ben, you were right, 40 years ago. Then section 1.3.4 talks about developments in the theory of catechesis, which shifted it much more in the direction of an adult voluntary activity. And this created a real problem for countries like Australia, New Zealand and the UK with big Catholic school systems where catechesis was the word that had been associated with religious education, almost meant the same. For example, in Ireland, the word religion teacher was never used. That's still in the 2017, there's called catechists. In Australia, the catechist term is used for those who teach religion in the government schools on a voluntary basis. But you can see how strong was that link. And so when the idea of catechesis shifted more in its original direction to being an adult voluntary faith-sharing activity, it said, well, what does that say about the school? What are we doing if we're not doing catechesis? And so it caused quite a lot of concern for a while until I think the idea of understanding that, okay, if schools can't do catechesis, it's all right. It's not an adult parish. It's not an adult Christian initiation group. It's a school. It's concerned about educating young people in the faith tradition, and therefore the word religious education is actually much more appropriate to the school, much more at home, much more natural, where the expectations for educating them in religious education will be quite different from what you would expect from the rite of Christian initiation of adults. Now, you can have a quick glance through the text if you wish. 1.3.6 is related to this. It's interesting because in 1976, James Westerhoff published a book called Will Our Children Have Faith? And he said, this instructional paradigm that we're using for religious education is a waste of time. It really should be what he called a community enculturation paradigm. But what people don't understand is he was talking about Sunday schools. It's exactly what a Sunday school is. It's like an extension of the Sunday liturgy. It was voluntary. It was for kids who were strong, regular members of the faith community. And so he was quite right. A community enculturation, a liturgical focus, not something like classroom curriculums and assessments and reporting and exams and outcomes and assessment rubrics. You know, they didn't want that in a Sunday school. But what happened was in the Catholic sector, that book became highly popular, was applied to Catholic schools, and it reinforced a movement at the time saying, no, we don't want any instruction or anything academic or challenging. We just want community. Go in and be a community and socialise them into the community and let them sit on beanbags and listen to music and exchange their ideas. You know, it was great in theory, but in practice it turned out to be reasonably disastrous because schools are about work and study. And if you introduce something that's really laid back, it's just perceived by the students as Mickey Mouse. And even though it might seem to be great to let them share their ideas and so on, it really didn't work. And so I think the point being made there is that if schools are about study and learning the intellectual tradition in the culture and critical thinking, then what you do with religion has to be the same as that for any other subjects. If it's a non-subject, eventually it's going to be, ignored because it has no real significance. So that's all that is said in section 1.3. If you were really keen and had the time, there are two articles there that go back to the early 1980s, when there was this great debate about catechesis and religious education, you know, the old chestnut. I can remember meeting with the Italian educators around about this time in Rome at the Salesian University, and for them this had never been an issue. They never had any argument about this at all. They thought school is about educating people in the culture, hence educate them in the religious culture. Catechesis is for voluntary youth ministry and adults, and never had any problem with that. But it's interesting that in England, in Australia, and to a lesser extent in the US and even in New Zealand, there was this great debate about is it catechesis or is it religious education. The article that I wrote, I chose this, what I thought at the time was a very snappy title, Stifling Union or Creative Divorce Between Catechesis and Religious Education. And it was really stupid, really unfortunate use of a title, because using the word divorce alienated a number of readers and they didn't even read it. So it's not much use writing something that you want people to consider and think about if you irritate them and, hurt them in the very choice of title. So I learned a lesson there of being, you can't be too smart and stupid. It would have been much better to say, to have something like just the relationships between catechesis and RE. Thomas Groom, when he read this, didn't like it at all, and he's never forgiven me, even though he's a friend, we meet and we have good time together. He's a great, very generous, courteous, cordial sort of man, but he's never forgiven me for raising questions about the term catechesis, which for him is still very important. And so you can see that these differences in the views of scholars, can go on for a lifetime. Then if you really wanted to, there's the article by Michael Warren. The article that, in my opinion, is the best that looks at the differences between the two, showing that they are different but complementary. So now we return to the main section text in section 1.4, where it simply argues what I've just said, that there's a need for both. And there's a table there taken from Michael Warren's article, which shows the way he sees such a significant difference between catechesis as the adult or the youth ministry activity for people who are believers and part of a faith community, with religious education, which he saw as, the objective study of religion, either in a theology institute or in a school, or maybe even in a parish, but he highlights the differences between the two. Now in section 1.5, what this does here, it says, look, the same sort of thinking that has been used in those previous sections, 1.3 and 1.4, and arguing that there's a need for greater clarity about the meaning of catechesis and the limited extent to which that construct may or may not be appropriate for what normally happens in classrooms, which teachers are very familiar with, then you can apply the same to the use of the term evangelization and new evangelization. And the argument that I would like to follow through with further in this section is that it is not about education. Evangelization is primarily about the Christ-like way in which an individual treats another so that they then see this is what Jesus Christ is like today and what he's about. You can't educate people in that. That has to be interpersonal. It's not propositional or educational. So that same sort of argument about looking very carefully at the origins and initial use and etymology of the word and how it's used can lead one to greater clarity about the extent to which this and any other ecclesiastical term is going to be applied. And I think you can see the bias that I like to bring to this is just don't accept it. Don't accept that any word is perfectly suitable. It has to be scrutinized and you work out what aspects, what dimensions of that religious construct, which usually apply to the whole of the church's ministry, which parts of that are appropriate to the classroom teaching of religion. And what I do suggest, and we look at this again later, is that there is a dimension to evangelization that is particularly well suited to the classroom, and that is where there's the emphasis on the critical interpretation and evaluation of the way that culture can have a shaping influence on people's beliefs and behaviour. 1.6 simply suggests that there are quite a number of other issues. I've noticed 15 there that all need religion teachers to have some point of view on what is the answer to all of those questions. And I think that the the thinking and the argumentation that's gone on in this whole section so far would help people come to their own particular view of where to stand on each one of those 15 issues. The next section makes a list of a number of the ecclesiastical terms, and I think the two that seem to have great buzz value today are the terms Catholic identity and faith formation. And I would think that they have been given much, much more prominence than they really need, in my own opinion, and I believe that it has substituted for and taken away from attention that should have been given to religious education. My comment about Catholic identity is that it's such an extraordinarily complex word. It depends on what sort of Catholic and what sort of identity. There are so many different sorts of Catholics, and I think we need to be careful that we have an inclusive one. And I think that the term is useful if you break it down into all of its subcomponents, like there's the nominal identity, it's owned by a Catholic Church. Then you have the moral identity, how Christian and how caring and how loving are the relationships between staff and in their care of students. That's a sort of moral Catholic identity. Then there's the architectural identity, you know, do they have paintings, crucifixes, chapel and so on. Then there's the liturgical identity, what level of liturgy and celebration of Mass occurs in the school. Then there's the prayer, Catholic prayer identity, when a prayer is said and that sort of thing. So there are all sorts of things that go into Catholic identity, and so if you don't use more precision in what it means, I think it can be very problematic. Later, I give special attention to faith formation and faith development that I think will show that they're problematic terms, because they're a real understanding of the complexity of faith as a relationship of fidelity and personal commitment to God. Then when you put it with a word like development or formation, I think you run into a lot of difficulties. We've said something about the other terms too, but I think that all religious educators should be able to go through these terms, and stimulated by what's written there, you may not have to agree with that in precisely, but each one of you should have your own precise definition for each one of those terms, so that you know what you're talking about, so that when you come to the reading and writing of theorists and key thinkers and so on about religious education, you have some sort of baseline from which you can make an evaluative judgment about, well, how do they compare to my view on this? Where do they fit in? What have they emphasised? What have they underemphasised? Is their theory appropriate? So I think it is crucial to have some understanding of those ecclesiastical terms so that they can be helpful and not something that is like a chain that limits people's thinking and constricts it. Now 1.8 is just a brief comment about experience that a lot of religion teachers will have had going back to the 1960s, that at the time you would never meet a religion teacher who thought that the sole or exclusive purpose of classroom religious education was to get young people to go to Mass or to be part of a faith community. There was always the hope that that would be the case. Most of the religion teachers then were members of religious orders. Their whole lives had been dedicated to the church, so you couldn't fault or question that commitment, not if you've given your whole life to the church. But they saw that in addition to the ecclesiastical hopes, I don't think you make them expectations, that young people might become part of a faith community, they also balanced that, and it was in creative tension with their own understanding and appreciation of what were the personal development needs of those students. So in other words, I think there was a creative tension between what the bishops and clergy expected and what the teachers expected in terms of contributing something to the personal, social, moral and spiritual development of the students through religious education. It was never just ecclesiastical. And I believe that if priests and bishops had to teach Year 9 for 3 years, we'd probably never have any of these problems because they'd really understand. Often I think, well, it's been my 50-year experience, that teachers know that the expectations of bishops and clergy are just unrealistic. You know, they just don't know what it's like to teach relatively secularised kids who may be very indifferent to religious education, not necessarily antagonistic or spiteful or uncooperative, but just disinterested. And to understand how and why that's happened over, you know, so many years. So I would suggest that creative tension has actually decreased or declined, because once the independence of the religious orders and the religious order schools was gone, when most of them gone and most of the schools becoming diocesan, then the control of the language and the thinking of religious education became almost exclusively ecclesiastical, that in a sense the church had a much more controlling influence over how people even thought and talked about religious education, as has become evident in all of the buzzwords like faith formation, faith development, Catholic identity and so on. These were never used very much at all in the 1960s and early 1970s. It was just, how can we religiously educate these young people? Even if a lot of the things that were done in the 60s and 70s were now judged to be very inappropriate, at least I think the language, there was more of a comfortable fit between what they were trying to do and the words, even though a lot of the trial and error of the 1960s and early 1970s showed that the estimates of what people thought could happen in religious education were unrealistic and problematic. So I think that, as noted in the text here, by the 1990s, there was a general consensus about what might be called a more subject-oriented to Catholic school religious education, and ideas about educating them religiously in their own religious tradition became more common. But I think that the rise of these other terms, the ecclesiastical terms, that are more about the religious faith and the religious lives of people, tended to skew thinking in the direction of that, of faith and religious life, rather than what does it mean to educate. I think you could be even very bold to say that, look, educating them in theology is actually a better term than educating them in faith. They're educating them in the faith tradition, but whether your religious education actually enhances their personal faith is something over which teachers have no control. If it's to be an authentic change in faith, it must come from within the individual. And after all, religious faith is seen as a free gift from God, so you can't make that happen. But what we can do really very well is educate them in their religious tradition. So you can see there in 1.9 and 1.10, there are arguments that suggest that the terms, well, the excessive use of the term faith development and faith formation has, in my professional opinion, and I believe there's evidence for it, but a lot of people don't want to look at this evidence and they don't want to collect any further evidence on it because I think it's been counterproductive. The text there talks about the word formation, which came into Australian Catholic usage through the religious orders in the first half of the 20th century, where novitiates and training colleges, etc., were called houses of formation. They were like religious marine boot camps, with the added concern that this is what God wanted of you, so it made it even more intimidating. And so the connotation of the word formation is forming, moulding, conforming uniformity, obedience. And I think that these are not words that go with the word education. And it may well be that when bishops and clergy who seem to favour this term prefer faith formation to religious education, it may be that they think somehow it is superior, it is more effective, and that somehow education is inferior to formation. My own view is, with those meanings of the word formation, if you put it with the words faith, you end up with something like an oxymoron. You cannot form faith. Why would you want to? It has to be a free gift coming. The response has to be from the free heart of the individual. And when you use words like that have connotation like marching in formation, for me, I think it would be abhorrent to link this word formation with faith. And also it seems to have enormous difficulty in appreciating how valuable it is to educate young people's faith and to educate them in their own faith tradition. So that you can see my position as one of being very critical of the use of this word faith formation. I never use it. I only refer to it in the way of offering a critique. And you need to make up your own mind on this. But I do think it's worth asking the question, why would people choose the word faith formation to religious education? I mean, if you came from Mars and you looked at different activities, how would you know which activities were religious education and which ones were faith formation? Unless you had a faith meter or a Holy Ghost detector. I think it's quite incongruous to use words like that, where you're making enormous presumptions that some activity is going to change the faith of people. It's going to develop, it's going to form it. And I think that when I hear people using the word, what really is the meaning underneath it is like a recruitment campaign. You talk about faith formation or new evangelization. It's some activity that will get people back to church. And I don't think that's an issue that we're primarily concerned about. We hope that will happen. And I think the best thing that can be done for that is to educate them well in their own faith tradition. And by educating them theologically and scripturally and in critical thinking, you're educating their knowledge component of their personal faith, their understanding and appreciation of their personal faith. That, I think, we can actually do, and you can actually get some measures of that in terms of knowledge and skills. But I would suggest that the language there is very problematic. Also, I would suggest that the emergence of a whole lot of new religious leadership positions, like director of Catholic Identity, a coordinator of mission, dean of mission and Catholic Identity, director of evangelization, faith development coordinator, I think that a lot of this is misguided. I think it's simply because of the buzz character of words like faith formation and new evangelization. Because as suggested before, I think evangelization is primarily about how Christ-like you are. And we should be doing that. And there's no problem with doing that, but it's not a pedagogy. It's not a content for religious education. And you see there's a quotation from one postgraduate student who had four different titles in 2 years, or 2 or 3 years. And she said that the role description for all four of the positions was pretty much the same. There weren't any significant differences. So you wonder, well, what's the purpose of introducing all of those new terms, director of mission and so on? I think the word mission has more value than the others, but I think they're all problematic. I'd be happy with religious education coordinator. Of course, there's no problem in differentiating the role and having two people to share the leadership. That's not in question. That can be very helpful. But I wonder whether all these fancy terms have added anything. And in my own inspection, anecdotally, and I would love to do research on this, he hasn't made any difference. I can't see any difference except that they've had a few more professional development topics around Catholic identity and evangelization, and some of the language has changed, and there might be a few documents going out here and there. But in terms of what actually happens in the school, I just think they're doing well what they normally did well before, and my opinion is, hasn't made any change, so why go to all that trouble? And my real concern is that it has distracted from spelling out with greater clarity what it means to educate young people's personal faith and to educate them within their own Catholic faith tradition. And so that's the summary position that comes in there in section 1.11. It just sums up that point that I have just been making. Now, I think that you would see from the bias that I bring to this that I consider that excessive use of ecclesiastical terms has resulted in backward steps for religious education. I believe it has affected negatively its status as an academic subject, because I think if teachers and students and parents can say, well, this is the church side of things, this isn't really a part of our education, they dismiss it more readily, because the reality is they come with a very poor opinion of the church. I'm not telling you anything new. This is just the reality. We can make religious education more meaningful and relevant. Making the church relevant is another topic altogether. If I had a class of bishops and priests, I wouldn't be talking about religious education. We would be talking over lots of other things that can make the living of the faith community more meaningful and relevant, that really offers something attractive and helpful to people in their own lives. It's an issue we can't really deal with here. Very important one for Catholicism. But what we're really on about here is, how can we get a language of religious education that helps us make our task, our humble task of teaching religion in the classroom, more meaningful for students, more realistic, more humble, less presumptuous about what we're trying to achieve? We're just trying to educate them well, so that when they leave Catholic school, we can tell that they're well educated in Catholicism and in religion and religious issues generally. What they do with this, how they relate to a community of faith, is a totally different issue over which we don't have any control. But what we can do well, we should be able to do very well. And I think that the problem about excessive attention to an ecclesiastical view of religious education, and I believe that there is a legitimate expectation from an ecclesiastical perspective, but I think if it is not held in creative tension with the teachers and the personal development needs of the students and the educational needs of students, then you get a very one-sided, and my own experience has been, excessively unrealistic view of what the classroom teaching of religion is about. And in the last section, number 12, in the right-hand side of the photographs, I put a priest in the pulpit, and I think that this has been, unfortunately, the overriding icon or symbol of school religious education. It's like the church telling the kids what they've got to believe, and that it is very ecclesiastical, very church-oriented. And I don't think that is the reality of the situation of semi-state schools owned by the church, where there's a partnership between parents, church, and state, where religious education needs to be more objective, strongly in the vein of educating them within the Catholic tradition so that they have great access to it and they know it really very well. I have no problem with that. But an exclusively ecclesiastical orientation, I think, symbolised by that icon of the priest in the pulpit, is not an appropriate model for the school and the classroom. It's a right model for the church. For, you know, the model of the priest sharing the word of the Christian gospel with the believers. I just wish it could be more sharing it, hence it'd be very much a one-way model. The people can't often jump up and say, hey, Father, what about this? Or can you elaborate on that point? I think much greater interactivity would be there. So I think that in today's parishes, maybe that model is not the best. But anyway, that's another issue. But what I'm suggesting is the situation that Catholic schools face culturally is more like that of the ancient agora in Greece, in Corinth, and these other Greco-Roman cities. In the photograph, there are two photographs there where St. Paul actually walked in the first century, where he joined with the great dialogue going on in the wider, it was the public domain, where people debated philosophy, meaning in life, belief in God, what sort of God, politics, human development, all those sorts of things. And it says in the Acts of the Apostles that Paul was talking with these people about the issue of, is there an unknown God? And who might this unknown God be? And what might be the inspiration and the, you know, the great value of the Christian interpretation of life as epitomized in Jesus, who was regarded as Savior? It's like this may well be a more appropriate model for the whole Catholic school. It's really a marketplace, a religious marketplace, where we are certainly, as Paul did, representing the Christian tradition, but in an objective, open, debating community where all sorts of issues in life are being considered. And I'd like you to look at that picture, that model of the ancient agora. And to me, it would seem a more relevant, overarching icon or symbol of where we are in the Catholic school, trying to represent a religious tradition and educate religiously. But it's not a one-way authoritative priest to parishioners pulpit model. It's more an open, inquiring study of the issues, looking critically at culture, being well informed about the religious tradition and even studying that critically and creatively. So I leave the end of this section, which has looked into issues and problems with the language of religious education, with those two icons, suggesting my own professional view that this is worth considering, that the ancient agora model, Paul on the Rock of the Areopagus, is a more realistic and relevant icon for Catholic school and for Catholic school religious education than the other alternative. And I believe that that excessive attention to ecclesiastical terms has been counterproductive. You may not necessarily agree with that, but I hope that you'll look through all the arguments and all the evidence that's presented there and make up your own mind on this. And it puts practitioners in an interesting position. You're always going to have bishops and you're always going to have conservative curricula from the point of view of conserving the religious tradition. But I would hope that teachers in their own mind and in their own language, even though they've got to accept curricula and so on that are given to them, that they can still have a freedom to see that excessive attention to that dimension is counterproductive, and that there's a need for a creative tension between ecclesiastical hopes and concerns, and the hopes and concerns, particularly the educational ones, that we have for the personal development of the relatively secularized students that we have in religion classes today.